welcome back to Arthropod on the Road. I am your co-host, Jody Green.
I'm Jonathan Larson.
And today we have a special guest that we have found roving around the Entomological Society of America. We found Cheryl Hostler, the roving naturalist.
Welcome.
Thanks for joining us on the show. It's really awesome to meet you. I was looking at some tweets the other day, and I saw some people talking about you and your YouTube channel, and I thought, I'm so jealous. I've always wanted a YouTube channel. I think that that's a really cool thing. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what your show is and why they should tune in?
Yes. So The Roving Naturalist is my experiment into making educational videos. And my sort of mission statement is that I would like to answer all of the questions you never knew you had about how humans and the environment interact. So all kinds of environmental science. I mean, focusing a lot on bugs because I love bugs and that's what I study, but also environmental education because I have a background in that and things like green living. I want to explore stuff about how we grow our food and where our waste goes and basically everything about humans use how humans use nature. Yeah.
And you're the star, the narrator, the host, or
I don't
how
know
does
that
it...
I would say star, but I'm the host. Okay. Yeah. So I do a lot of talking head style face to camera video. But I've also been doing a lot of interviews while I'm here with other entomologists. I'm really passionate about showing people what scientists look like. A lot of people have this sort of concept of the old white guy with crazy hair wearing a lab coat, holding an Erlenmeyer flask with some sort of bubbling liquid in it. But like most of us don't look like that.
No.
And
some of us do.
Well, I mean, yeah. I'm really interested in showing the diversity of what scientists look like and what scientists do. So the interviews are an important part as well. So it's not just my face.
That's awesome. And can I ask why this was a passion of yours? Why this was something that really ignited you?
Yes. So like I said, I have a background in environmental education. So I worked for a while as a naturalist at nature centers and zoos and aquariums, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But the audience that we reach at those places is mostly self-selected. Those are families that are already interested in protecting nature and learning
That's
more about
true,
science.
Yeah.
So as much as I loved doing that, I felt like I might be able to have a broader impact by using the power of the internet to find people who might not think to go to those locations.
Absolutely.
So instead of you having to come to a nature center, I bring nature to you because I almost always film outside.
Cool.
Yeah.
I like to hear that kind of stuff because Jody and I have talked about this before. We do a lot of individual contacts. People come to the office and they know about extension or they know about science a little bit already, but I like mass communication. I don't like one at a time in them. I want to get to as many people as possible. So I like hearing that kind of philosophy from others. Have you had a good meeting so far?
Yes, this has been overwhelming, but a ton of fun. I've made a lot of great friends and I've learned a lot of cool stuff. So yeah.
Jody, how about you? Have you had a good meeting?
I've had a very fun meeting. I was really tired last night. I almost... like fall asleep.
Have you had a favorite section or symposium that you've been to?
Oh my gosh. I'm sort of bouncing back and forth between ecology and beetle stuff because I study beetles and also all of the science communication things because I'm a SciComm nerd. I wasn't expecting there to be so much science communication content going on here. That makes me really hopeful for the future because I am glad that there are more scientists becoming invested in communicating what they do to other people.
Did you get to present your research?
I did.
Yeah.
Yes. So I talked on Monday right before lunch. It's 8 minutes is not a whole lot of time to talk about what you've been doing for a whole year. But yeah, so 8 minutes of talk, 2 minutes of questions.
So
it flies by.
In 15 seconds.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So I study dung beetles in the restored prairie. So dung beetles are important because without them, poop just sort of lays on the ground and it smothers plants. So, grazing animals can't eat plants that are covered in poop. So we need some way to get rid of the poop and dung beetles are probably the most effective way for that to happen. So I'm working in the restored prairie because most of the prairie that was originally on this continent is gone. It's been turned into agricultural land. So as we replant and sort of foster the regrowth of the prairie, how do the dung beetles deal with the prairie coming back?
Okay. And what state are you doing this in?
In Illinois, in northwestern Illinois. Okay.
It used to be a lot of prairie, right?
Yes. Illinois is called the prairie state.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Yes. I would never have placed that nomen.
Yeah, now we're the corn state. Yeah. But at one point, the state of Illinois was like 99% covered in tall grass prairie or something like that. Huh. And now we're down to less than like 0.001% of our original prairie, which is kind of sad. A lot of it is sort of like random hillsides that nobody wanted to plow into farmland or like little corners of old graveyards, which is a really great place to find prairie plants, surprisingly. But yeah, most of the flat land was turned into fields.
Yeah, we see that a lot out there in Nebraska too. What kind of dung beetles do you see? What's the range of dung beetle diversity?
So I am primarily finding five species and then like one genus where they're so small I'm not bothering to identify them as species. But I find a lot of the tunneler dung beetles. So when most people think about dung beetles in like a nature documentary, they picture a big one like rolling a ball of elephant dung across the savanna. But not all dung beetles roll balls of dung. Mm. So the tunnelers actually will find a dung pat and sort of dig a hole down through it and dig a tunnel under the ground. And then they'll pull dung from the dung pat down into the tunnel and lay their eggs next to it. And then the babies hatch out and eat the dung and live in the tunnel until they're adults and then they come out.
That's awesome.
The type of dung beetles that are in my dog's poop when I pick it up?
If they're in the poop, those are... Oh, if they're under it, they might be tunnelers. If they're in it, they would be dwellers, which, you know, makes sense. But yeah, the dwellers, the adults, and the babies all live in the original dung pat together.
It dwellers and tunnelers. It also amazes me that I never ever see any unless I'm picking up the dog poop. So like, if I don't have the dog poop, should I be picking up the dog poop? Do they have enough food then, or are they just going to fly off and find...
Oh, I mean, yeah, they have wings. They can fly around. And I guess that's the thing about poop. It is a, we say it's a patchy resource, both spatially and temporally. So both in space and in time. So yeah, they have to have the ability to move around in their environment and find new sources. because yeah, it goes away because they're using it and then it gets dropped somewhere else as an animal moves across the landscape.
So. How do they find it? How do they orient towards it?
Mostly, by smell.
Okay.
So they mostly find, exactly. So mostly by smell. So when dung is dropped, it's wet and fresh and stinky and they're able to find it that way.
Right.
Also a little bit by sight. There are some dung beetles that'll go up on like vegetation and sort of scope out the landscape. But yeah, it's mostly smell.
And how do they dig through it? How do they tunnel into it?
They've got, so my advisor likes to say that they have, bell-bottom legs.
Uh-huh.
So dung beetles have a very distinct sort of shape to all of their legs. And yeah, it looks like bell-bottom pants. So they've got kind of this like big, space right at the end before their toes, and those big powerful legs are good for and they also have sort of shovel shaped heads,
right?
So they can burrow with their heads and dig with their legs and
fossorial leg and head combo.
Sure.
You don't hear about that too often.
No.
So what is like the coolest thing that you've seen so far? Or
oh my gosh, the coolest thing I've seen so far in my research? That's hard because just being out in the prairie, you see a lot of cool things that don't have anything to do with the dung beetles. Like there are amazing flowers and I love watching the bison because they're amazing creatures. But as far as the dung beetles, we've got one species that's just really, really pretty. It's called Phanius vindex, or the common-ish name is the rainbow scarab, and they're iridescent, sort of like orangey copper on the shield part right behind their heads, and then iridescent green on their backs, and they're just, they're really amazing, and the males can have a very big, dramatic, like, horn that comes off of their nose, and their antennae have little orange balls on the end, so I just think they're really fun to look at.
They're pretty.
Yeah.
I identify with the nose part. I was kind of curious with your YouTube channel and the videos you make. Is it focused just on what you're doing? Are you going around and meeting friends that do research? Or do you have a huge budget? Are you independently wealthy and travel the country? Or?
I wish I had a huge budget. No, this is for funsies. I do it with, you know, what I have of my quote unquote disposable income.
Right.
So I do, do some videos talking about my research, but yeah, right now I've been having fun interviewing other people and learning about their stuff too, to diversify, because nobody wants to hear about my research all the time.
All poop all the time.
Yeah.
I did.
I mean,
we know what we like. Are you collecting some data off of your show, or?
What do you mean?
Are you like YouTube analytics? You're figuring out people that are watching it?
A little bit. I mean, my show has only been, this show has only been up for a few months, okay. So I'm still sort of early in figuring it out. But I've gone to VidCon, which is the YouTube conference, the past 2 years, and there have been a lot of interesting conversations among the education creators, even, you know, other women education content creators, even like LGBTQ content creators that say that most of their analytics say that like primarily middle-aged men are watching. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to tease apart if that is the cause or the effect. So are middle-aged men watching the science content because they are the ones that are most interested in science? Or is it because the YouTube algorithm is suggesting science content to them and not to women or young people? Or is it because we still have not progressed far enough past the whole it's not cool for girls to be interested in science thing? And I think at the heart of it, it's probably a little bit of all of those things.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But we are trying to figure out ways to get other groups to be watching us. And it's weird because you'll think that you've built a video that would hit all the tick boxes for like being interesting to women, and it'll still primarily have like male viewers. So
I really wonder about that algorithm sometimes, yeah. Because it's a very powerful thing and kind of a hard thing to tackle. I think it just seems like a self-perpetuating thing.
Yeah, a lot of us have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, and it's also interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize this, but like when you create your Google account for Gmail and right. your YouTube account and whatever, if you don't specify your gender, the algorithm will sort of like pick one for you. And so there's been some thought that if you are watching primarily scientific content, the algorithm might like guess that you're a guy, even right. if you're not. Because they just anticipate that guys are more into educational content. Mm. So that's like a whole nother sort of like, about, yeah.
When you were saying that, I was like, how do they collect that? I'm like, if it's optional, I usually don't pick one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like if you're watching a lot of science content, they might have assumed that, your account is male.
That is weird. Well, and then I've been reading about this, the Facebook-YouTube rivalry where Facebook won't let you put YouTube content on. And do you have a Facebook page for your show?
I do. So there's a way to get around that, which, yeah. Because if you just put your link or like embed your video into Facebook, then it doesn't provide the same, yeah, like monetization or the same analytics on YouTube. So instead, if you post the thumbnail for your video and then post the link, it means that the video doesn't become embedded on Facebook. So when somebody clicks on the link, it redirects them to YouTube.
Okay.
So I use my Facebook account for the channel more as a way to just like grab extra people and redirect them over to the YouTube channel rather than trying to have the views directly on Facebook.
Right on.
Yeah.
I like it. Well, I wanted to say thanks for being on our show today. This was really awesome. I love meeting energetic people who are doing psych communication as well. How can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at RVING Naturalist, because roving was one too many letters. or you can search for me on YouTube, The Roving Naturalist. I don't have the fancy URL yet because I'm still under 100 subscribers, but thank you for having me on, and yeah. I'm assuming we'll hit that milestone sooner rather than later.
Go subscribe, check it out. It looks really cool. I'm going to watch them on my vacation that I'm going to take after ESA here. So thanks for being on. Have a good rest of the conference.